As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best of economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Our first guest this morning, Jens Nordvik. He led currency strategy and fixed income research for Nomura Securities. Then he founded Exante Data. He's now the CEO of that company. And Jens is in our Bloomberg 1130 studios in New York. Great to have you with us once again.
Thank you very much.
Let me start by asking you, Jens, if I could, just about this trip. Let's use that as the peg to talk here about China and Chinese monetary policy in particular. What's the status of market liberalization in China? What did we learn from the People's Congress of a few weeks ago?
Well, so I think the big dynamic we've seen this year is that they imposed capital controls going into 2017, and those controls have been successful. So we managed to get the currency under control. It had been under a lot of pressure for the previous 2 years, and that's kind of allowing the authorities to again think about what they really want to do in the long term, and that is a more open currency market. So I think we're starting to see moves in that direction. So, for example, they essentially had restrictions on how you trade the forwards in the currency market that they now lifted after having them on for 2 years. So that's the direction we're going. They're also super, super keen on getting foreign participation in the bond market. So they did a presentation in New York, first one ever, a couple of weeks ago. So that's a part of that marketing effort. So that's their goal.
How effectively have they been doing that? In other words, how much international attention or interest have they attracted?
Well, so I think a lot of investors globally got pretty scared of this control wave. If you're a big money manager, do you like the idea of capital controls? Absolutely not. So it's going to take a little bit of time before they do get comfortable with the sort of new path we're on now. But a lot of people are definitely getting ready. So you can sort of look at statistics of how many funds have gotten approval to trade Chinese bonds, and that list is getting longer and longer and longer. And we are starting to see some inflows. I wouldn't say they're huge, but they're starting. So I think that's something really to watch. If there's a big move into Chinese bonds over the next couple of years, it could be one of the biggest new themes in the global fixed income markets.
Jens, I listened to the rhetoric from the president on this trip. Again, he's focused on this trade deficit, and we look for clarity on what this administration's trade policy is as this trip through Asia continues. How much of a weight is that on currencies in particular, just the uncertainty about U.S. trade policy?
Well, so we've seen it, and it's played out very clearly in Mexico, where obviously in the run-up to the election, we had a very big move. We had a further extension of the move into early 2017, and then we calmed down a little bit. We've not seen very much in other currencies, I think, because we've not had any sort of specific disagreement that is about to explode. So this would be very interesting whether there's something more specific coming up soon. But I guess the North Korea issue is one factor that's actually keeping Trump at bay, in the sense that he doesn't want to push too hard until that issue is resolved. But it is a very important issue overall. So at my company, we actually hired a specific person to cover this issue only. Uh-huh. That tells you something about yes. How focused we are on it. And the negotiations around NAFTA are going to sort of come to a head in the next 3 to 6 months. There's a deadline in Q1. So we will get something there. And it's something that I think in some markets it is underestimated how big the risk of a blow-up is.
Let me turn domestic if I could. Michael McKee, our colleague, sat down with the U.S. Treasury Secretary yesterday, and I was wondering, going into that interview, so what you might have to say about the strength of the U.S. dollar, about the U.S. strong dollar policy. Do you have clarity on that? Do we see a continuation of that strong dollar policy that's been in place now for many years?
Well, so I've made the point for a while now that Trump is not exactly a strong dollar guy.
Not a strong dollar guy.
So yeah. We have him talk the deficits down all the time.
Yeah.
And he has actually been actively talking the dollar down early in the year. So that's definitely his position. I think on the sort of dollar outlook, I think we're moving into what I would call a more tactical phase. And what I mean by that is that we had a very big dollar appreciation move from the summer of 2014 to early this year. And when we've seen some pretty big retracement from February to September, and now we're starting to sort of bounce around in a range. And I think we're going to see more of that. And the reason for that is that we have come through a period where it was only the Fed that was tightening policy. Mm. And now other economies around the world are catching up. So the difference between how the U.S. is doing and other economies are doing is just not as big as it used to be. And that means that these big structural moves in the FX market, they're probably behind it, and it's going to be more tactical from here.
Let's talk a bit about the Fed that Jay Powell is going to inherit. Of course, Jerome Powell has been on the Fed as a governor for some time now, but he'll be taking over as chair if all goes according to what the president has planned. What does this Fed look like? What's in its toolkit? If there's another crisis, does it have all it needs?
Well, the first thing I would say is that obviously we had the chair nomination that was important, but we also have a lot of other open seats at the Fed.
Yeah.
So my former boss at Goldman, Bill Dudley, resigned on Monday. That's another open seat. Yellen is probably going to resign from the board. There's another open seat. We have Fisher's seat. So there's a lot of moving parts. We just don't know who's going to be setting policy in 2019, like 18 and 19 and so forth. So that's a big uncertainty. I think the tricky bit is that on the one hand, the economy is doing better. We have these names floating around who could fill those empty seats that sound hawkish. But on the other hand, inflation is just not there. So what does the Fed do now if we have another couple of weak inflation prints? This is really a dilemma for the Fed. Mm-hmm. Do they see through it or do they pause the hiking cycle? The market is sort of buying into the notion that December is a done deal. And I do think December is likely. But if we have another couple of weak inflation prints, I think the Fed is going to have to make a very difficult decision, actually. So that is something we have to watch carefully. We have another CPI print next week, so watch that one.
Yeah, is that going to be the moment when we see the first contours of a Jay Powell Fed? In other words, what's the date on the calendar, the point at which we would see him making an imprint on this Federal Reserve?
Yeah, I think if he does a speech after the next CPI number, let's say we have a weak CPI number, then a lot of people will be listening to how does he interpret that data. In the past, it's been Yellen's interpretation, and now they're going to be watching more and more what he says. So the first couple of speeches he's going to deliver is going to be absolutely key. And I think he's been very balanced in the past, balanced into how he interprets the data, and also quite pragmatic. So it'll be very, very important to see if he continues that line of thinking.
Let me ask you, Lassa, we'll come back here in just a moment, talk about some currencies in particular, but let me ask you just about the composition of the Fed. You mentioned the vacancies that we have. How much does one person's leadership matter versus the full complement of the committee? And when are we going to get a better sense here of the shape of the direction that committee is going to go in?
Well, I guess it depends a little bit on how forceful a leader you have, how forceful a chair. And we don't really know exactly how Powell wants to assert himself, but I think he's been seen as somebody who was sort of within the consensus. So from that perspective, it matters a lot who the other guys are, what the consensus is actually going to be. I think for the New York Fed post, I think it's actually really important because Dudley was definitely in the dovish camp of the Fed in the last several years. If we had a more hawkish appointment there, that could be really changing the complexion of the Fed. For example, Warsh, who didn't get the Fed chair nomination, has been mentioned as somebody who could come out of the New York Fed. That would definitely be a shift, so that would be important. So those are the key points to watch out for as we learn more about what the new Fed is going to look like.
All right, well, let's come back here in just a moment. Talking with Jens Nordvig. He's with Exante Data, the founder of that company, the CEO of that company. He's joining us today from our studios in New York, our Bloomberg 1130 studios. I am downtown in the Oppenheimer Fund studios. Tom Keene making his way down here to join me as we broadcast from here. Jens Nordvig with us from Exante. He's in our Bloomberg 1130 studios in New York as we continue our conversation about geopolitics, fixed income, currencies as well. And let me go to the latest undulations of the Brexit debate, Jens. We have them get underway in Brussels again, and it seems like there's still the same intractability we've seen throughout this whole process. What are you watching as all of this unfolds when it comes to sterling in particular?
Well, so I think there's an interplay between Brexit, the currency, and then what the Bank of England is doing that's very interesting now. So I think the Bank of England has essentially changed its stance. Like, initially it was very afraid of Brexit, and it led them to be as easy as possible, and that has changed. So now what it's seeing is that Brexit is actually generating a kind of supply shock in the economy, and the currency is very, very weak, and it's actually generating inflation. So the UK is one of the few countries in Europe where there's meaningful inflation. They responded in November, and I think the more of this political uncertainty we have that takes the currency down, ironically, actually, the more the Bank of England will be forced to react and deliver more tightening to rein this inflation dynamic in. So it's pretty important shift that has happened, and I think we're going to see more of it.
Jens, what did you make of the Bank of England's decision to raise rates at that last meeting for the first time since 2007? You had the two most, I guess, technocratic members of the Monetary Policy Committee, the economists on the committee, voting against it happening. What did you make of their decision to do it?
Well, so I think it really has to do with the fact that they've been wrong on the economy. They've been expecting like a big confidence shock, and it just never materialized, right? So on the one hand, you have asset prices pricing in something very dire, and the currency is a part of that. The currency is very weak, and that's generating inflation. On the other hand, confidence in the economy is not so bad. So consumer confidence is not so bad. Business confidence is not so bad. And therefore, we've not seen the recession that was initially projected. So they're responding now to being wrong about that and delivering a hike to essentially at least remove the easing that they delivered right after Brexit. And I think they'll probably have to normalize rates more, because we still have this disconnect between the forward-looking markets that is generating inflationary pressure, and then consumer confidence that's not so forward-looking, and they just can't wait until Brexit has happened to see that confidence eventually come out. They have to be a little bit forward-looking as well.
On the subject of Bitcoin, I have to ask you about this, as I see this coming up more and more in conversations. Certainly you have the CEOs of major banks talking about it more, some expressing some skepticism. Some calling themselves neo-Luddites as they approach cryptocurrency. What do you make of where we are in terms of acceptance of Bitcoin, acceptance of cryptocurrency?
Well, it certainly is a very controversial topic. Yeah. So a couple of weeks ago, we actually wrote a public letter about it on exantedata.com. It was not because we want to have a strong view, okay, this is going to go to a certain level, or it's a bubble, it's going to explode. But it's because we're actually using Bitcoin as a macro indicator, similar to how we're using other macro indicators. So, for example, China is a country we're focused on, and we've had very interesting sort of capital flight dynamics playing out over the last couple of years. That's why they put in place the controls we discussed previously. And you can use the spread in the Bitcoin market to sort of see, okay, how keen are Chinese residents in terms of getting their money out? So we're using it to analyze things. And the market has gotten big enough that this is something that really matters. So we're watching it. As a firm, we don't have a view as to whether it's going to go up or down, but we're using the information within that market to say something about other dynamics in terms of capital flows. And we find it very helpful, and I think it's getting bigger. Volumes are going up, so it's going to be increasingly important to watch those signals.
Lastly here, with just about 30 seconds left, tell me just how important this tax reform process is going to be for the dollar going forward. It seems like there's optimism among Republicans that this is proceeding a pace. What does it mean for the economy and for the dollar going forward?
It's very important. Like, nothing has really gotten done in this administration so far, so they have to get this done to show some ability to do policy. And we've already seen in the equity market pretty big moves in anticipation of this happening. The dollar has also strengthened a bit. If the tax reform does not happen, if we have some news in coming months that suggests that this is falling apart, I think the dollar is going to have a very hard time holding. I think it's might likely to drift meaningfully weaker on the back of that news. So it's very important.
Jens, thank you very much for the time this morning, both on the Bloomberg Radio, Bloomberg Television as well. Do check out his interview from Bloomberg TV at TV Go on the Bloomberg. Jens Nordvik of Exante joining us in our Bloomberg 1130 studios in New York.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more. Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
It is a magical name from my ute in the open-end investment company, Oppenheimer Funds, which over the years, David, there was a fund a million years ago, the Oppenheimer Target Fund.
Uh-huh.
And they had a run of, I'll say, 20 years of growthiness, as Mr. Colbert would say. Over the years, they've migrated back to a, I'm going to say, all in all, a global view. And they've done that with some better than good performance. Christian Mamani with us, their chief investment officer. You're giving a speech in this beautiful building this morning, 10 a.m. The young troops walk in. What's your single message?
The single message is, in this sort of an environment, it's very easy for people to get kind of complacent or fearful. Fearful because we have had a very long run. Market levels are high, and therefore anticipating some sort of a crash. Yeah. I think that can paralyze people. And at the same time, because the markets haven't corrected in a big way, kind of not anticipating what sort of things, what sort of drivers in the markets to look at and ensure that if things are going to change, we have some ideas where it's coming from.
How correlated our international markets right now, whether it's market to market, across asset classes, it's something you've got a bunch of quants that they look at it 24/7. What are the correlations right now?
So the correlations in various markets is high, but I think the reason it is high is because the markets at the moment are being driven by synchronized global recovery. Ever since the energy crisis or the correction in oil prices, first quarter of 2016, since that incident, the markets, the global economies have come up together. And therefore, markets have gone up together as well. So it's they are correlated, but I don't think that's really a matter of huge concern. I think what we have to look at is what is going to happen over the next 2 years as opposed to what happened over the last 2 years. At this point, it seems to us that growth in emerging markets is getting deeper while growth in the U.S. is flattening out. And I think as you think about your investment strategy, that's the theme that you have to incorporate in your thinking.
How do you navigate that divergence then? If you're seeing the two things split off in the way that they are, is now a time to make moves?
So I would say, you know, it makes emerging market equities, emerging market debt, far more attractive than they have been at any point because valuations in emerging markets are much better than they are in developed markets, especially the U.S. And the fundamentals, economic growth in emerging markets is getting deeper and it is getting less China dependent. So if you look at an economy like Brazil, which was a basket case 2 years ago, and if this in 2018, if they grow at 2 or 3 or 4%, we wouldn't be surprised at all. So things are changing very rapidly in emerging markets. Growth is getting deeper, and I think that makes emerging markets far more interesting from an investment standpoint than developed markets. The big theme.
Tom, in his data check just a moment ago, mentioning volatility, they're hovering around.
Did I do okay?
Very good. Always a good data check, Tom. How do you navigate that, the low volatility that we've seen, and do you sense that we could see an uptick in that in any time soon?
Well, so low volatility. You look at low volatility, and you always get worried. Yeah. Am I missing something? Markets are too complacent. But I think you have to take a step back and try to figure out what is the driver of that low volatility. And at the moment, the driver of the low volatility is the synchronized global growth, low policy rates, and lack of inflation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If any of those things change, volatility would go up meaningfully.
But this is critical then. If any of those things change, one of them, or as you know, when they change, Christian, it's usually a set of them change. Can you manage the various glide paths? Will it be emerging market pain, which some of us have enjoyed? Or is it a manageable where you can shift assets and portfolios as we enjoy those changes?
So I think the pace of change is going to be more gradual than it has been in the past, for two reasons. One, the drivers of the economic drivers are far more stable. So inflation, which typically ends up upending things, really isn't that prominent a factor. And if it comes up, it'll come up very, very gradually. Yeah. So that's one. And second, policymakers are on the case. They are singularly focused on making sure that there are not significant dislocations in the economy, and that's why policy rates are as low as they are.
You mentioned policymakers. I mean, I want to stay international here, and the president gave this speech in Beijing today. Was that the ultimate mercantilist speech? I mean, come on. He went after Obama to Washington. I think he got Martin Van Buren in there. I don't know how he did that. But is it a zero-sum presidency in a world that you describe with Oppenheimer, which is truly global?
I think approaching global trade in a pure mercantile way, I think is not good for the world, and it's not good for the U.S., and it's not good for the overall growth that we need for us to be for all of us to prosper. I think globalization is a good thing. I think it has certainly created certain dislocations in some markets and some economies, and we have to find ways of dealing with that. But it's a baby in the bathwater kind of an argument. The fact that it has led to some unemployment in certain sectors of the U.S. economy doesn't make it singularly bad for the overall U.S. economy.
Did you see? We played it on television, David. It was extraordinary.
The speech.
How he basically said, "China, you're okay." But it's all these previous administrations. I was thunderstruck by it.
Yeah, and I think if you look at the reaction of those in the audience as well, there was some surprise at what he had to say. You talked about emerging markets exclusive of China. Help us understand the role that China is playing now when it comes to economic growth in the developing world and when it comes to just investment more generally.
So China is the second largest economy in the world and is growing faster than basically any developed market. The investments is a large component of that growth. Their savings rate is roughly 50%, 48% to be precise. And I think that volume of investments has impact globally because they end up being the largest consumer of commodities on a global basis. And therefore, what happens in China is very relevant to what happens for commodity prices, what happens to emerging market exports, and all of that stuff. When China was slowing down meaningfully because they cracked down on the investment, real estate, and things like that, we had a commodity issue in the market. Subsequent to that, things have stabilized as they put more stimulus in. So growth in China is very critical for growth in emerging markets. Having said that, I think as China slows down and other emerging markets kind of come out of their downdraft, the growth in emerging markets is becoming less dependent on China. And that's a good thing. Mm. That means that growth can be sustained and it'll be less volatile than it was over the last 5 years.
David Gurr and Tom Keene at the studios of Oppenheimer Funds New York, in downtown New York, and with us Krishna Mamani, Chief Investment Officer for Oppenheimer Funds, with a terrific international perspective. I want to rip up the script here, Krishna. I know that David wants to get the tax reform and all of our thoughts on the elections and what's going on in Washington. You were at Birla Institute of Technology. This is northwest of Calcutta, is that right?
Yes, it's northwest of, it's closer to Delhi than Calcutta.
Closer to Delhi, okay.
Yes.
I have two questions. The smog in Delhi, I find absolutely stunning. Is the media overplaying that, particularly the BBC, or is it factors worse than what I experienced in Mexico City or Beijing?
I think it's all true, unfortunately.
It's all true.
It's all true. You can eat the fog, as they say in Delhi. It's mind-bogglingly bad. And people say it's almost like 50 cigarettes a day kind of an environment. We Indians and the Indian government has to do something about it, because this is not sustainable in the long run.
So when you read and your team reads 47-page McKinsey, BCG, Bain documents on the build-out of infrastructure, what do you think of those documents, and how do you invest for it, knowing Delhi's desperate to fix what seems to be a world-class problem?
So I think for India, that is really the crux of the issue, and that is the primary difference between how things have worked out in India as opposed to China. That is, Chinese growth was, for all sorts of political and economic reasons, was very rapid because they could direct it. And in India, it's very difficult for them to do that. And because the infrastructure is poor and the investment rate has not been as substantial as the case in China, the potential or the risk to potential growth in India is significantly higher and will remain significantly higher relative to China.
What you don't know, David, is when Krishna and I were studying this stuff a million years ago, international investment was, which concrete company should we buy? That was literally the whole strategy. You bought one telephone, Telemex or whatever, T-Mex, you bought one telephone and one concrete company, done. And, you know, it's moved on to a little greater sophistication, to say the least.
You know, thankfully. the world today is full of really, really good companies. And at Oppenheimer Funds, the way we approach our investment philosophy is really not about geographies. It's not about India. It's not about China. It's really about great companies in India, great companies in China. Even if there is an economy that we don't like, we can always go out and find a company in that economy that we like, as we did with Russia and Brazil, which were sucking wind for a while.
Did you see how he got that messaging in there? That was smooth.
I'm learning from you.
Here at the Oppenheimer Fund Studios. David, jump in here on the U.S.
Yeah, let me ask you. I know that you were waiting with bated breath here to find out who the next Fed chair was going to be. So we have Jerome Powell, who's going to be filling that position if all goes according to plan. What's this Fed going to look like? How is it going to be different from Janet Yellen's Fed, if at all?
I don't think the core of the Fed is going to be dramatically different from Janet Yellen's Fed. I think what is far more important is the fact that this is a later cycle Fed than Janet Yellen was. So I think the policies that the Fed implements is not going to be because the Fed is different. It's just the economic cycle is at a different point. And our expectation is that there probably will be some tightening next year, probably will be some tightening in 2019. Whether that is 3 or 4 in 2018 and 3 or 4 in 2019, I think is up for debate. But the trend is, as economic growth in the U.S. remains stable and unemployment rate continues to go down, the trend in the U.S. is for tighter policy rather than easier policy. The exact opposite is happening in emerging markets. I think that's the one reason to like emerging markets. Policy rates or interest rates in emerging market, inflation in emerging markets, probably low or trending lower rather than higher, the opposite of what's happening in developed markets.
What are the consequences of the uncertainty surrounding personnel when it comes to the Fed? Jeffrey Lacker has been replaced in Richmond. Bill Dudley's announced his resignation. There are numerous seats around the big conference table in the Eccles building that haven't been filled with new individuals. What does that mean? Does it mean continuity by default, or does it mean there is a gap in understanding of what's going to happen?
Well, there certainly is. But I think at the end of the day, it's really a political issue. So with the appointment of Powell, I think Mr. Trump showed us what he's looking to do. That is, he's not looking for radical change in policy because that doesn't really serve him well politically or from a growth perspective. So there might be other replacements, but the likelihood that those replacements are radical, given the appointment of Powell, I think that risk has gone down. And the markets are kind of incorporating that in their outlook for rates.
Very quickly here, what's your outlook for tax reform? The likelihood that it happens, and what does it mean for the markets here? And I apologize, 30 seconds to feel that.
Well, I think some form of tax reform probably gets done because politically it suits everyone to get something done. Whether that is going to be meaningful and will change the direction of the economy, I think I'm not so sure. No. We will have some deficit, some incremental growth, some tax reform. It doesn't change the direction of markets materially.
Christian Momani, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it. He is with Oppenheimer Funds. It is not the essay of the day, the week, or even of this November. It is possibly the essay of our labor economy in this financial crisis. Ned Phelps, as always, writes well, writes clearly. He has written a jewel for Project Syndicate, Nothing Natural, about his, I should say, natural rate of unemployment. I can't say enough about the laureate's clarity in moving from the lessons we learned from Hicks and Marshall and Robert Solow of a school on the Charles River in Boston to Ned Phelps and the rebels of the 1960s. Well, Ned Phelps, honored to have you with us. What do we get wrong now in our labor economics? What's the number one message you have to this mystery of no wage growth?
Well, I think the big message is that the world is is much more of a complicated place than we recognize, and attitudes and beliefs and fears and hopes, they all play a big role in the behavior of workers, the demands of workers, wage setting by employers and so forth. So what I did in that column was I dreamed up three or four factors that might be slowing down the rate of increase of prices or the rate of increase of wages or both, because people are kind of disturbed by recent developments.
We just saw the president, Professor Phelps, give a mercantilist zero-sum speech in Beijing on America in trade. All of that tenor of the president comes out of the agony of a part of America that's not enjoying our economic growth, our prosperity, and our wealth and income gains. If you were sitting with the president, how would you advise him to a better economy that doesn't harken back to a failed mercantilism?
Great question, Tom. Well, I think the most fundamental thing we can do is to get economic growth back. We've just got to do that. I know there's a big debate raging about robots. Are they something that's good for growth, or actually will they ruin economic life for us? But just putting that for aside for a moment, I think we have to get the economy doing everything that's possible to innovate more, invest more, get productivity rising. Then everything will be so much better. And those folks in Appalachia who are kind of desperate, well, maybe they'll pick up and decide to go to California after all and take advantage of the high and rising wage rates. Right now, the market for their services is pretty bleak.
I take what you're saying, that we might see new pioneers heading West, go West, young man, and the like.
Yeah.
But when you listen to the rhetoric coming from Washington, from this president in particular, we hear about a renaissance of coal, for instance, or a return to economies that we'd seem to have left behind. How much does that matter? How much does the rhetoric coming out of Washington matter to the economic progress of this country?
Well, I don't think the people can eat the rhetoric. So, of course, I also think that reopening the coal mines would not be a good signal to send to the rest of the world when we're trying to get the rest of the world to respect the environment.
Professor, within the battle that we've just had over John Taylor and rules-based central banking, and we've gone with presumably Chairman Powell, where does your Nehru fit in? Bow ties on TV, wax philosophical, never on radio.
Never.
Wax philosophical about Phelps and Taylor's Nehru.
Yeah.
Would you please explain to mere mortals what you invented? What did Ned Phelps wrought?
I was one of those, like two of us maybe, I was one of those who sort of provided a theoretical foundation, for what it's worth, for the idea of a natural unemployment rate. That no matter what the inflation rate is as a customary thing, whether it's running at 2% per annum forever or at 5% per annum, it's the unemployment rate that will accompany that will be the same, because fundamentally the unemployment rate is determined by structural forces, not by the rate of inflation itself. Am I being clear?
Clear to me. Tom?
I don't know. I was dozing off. No. I was looking at how Columbia football is going to do this weekend.
Let me ask you about how the Fed looks at the economy now. And as I mentioned a little earlier on the show, we heard from Janet Yellen a few weeks back, speaking in Cleveland, talking about reckoning with forecasting in particular. What does the Fed need to do differently when it looks at the U.S. economy?
Well, I do think that there are some significant consequences for the extremely cheap money, easy money policies at the Fed and also at the ECB in the Eurozone. I think financial institutions have earned very low rates of return, and so I think the financial sector is not as healthy and robust, and not helping as much with helping businesses as much as it once would have done. I think it'd be good to try out higher interest rates and see whether that wouldn't be okay.
Well,
would be good, right? Because we want to be able to lower interest rates in the future when demand weakens. But we can't at the moment because all interest rates are already so low.
Now, we're going to have to leave it there, but that's an important point. Professor Phelps, we look forward to seeing you soon, particularly this idea of trying out higher interest rates. He's a laureate of 2006, Edmund Phelps of Columbia University.
And he'll be on Bloomberg Television as well, I know, speaking with Vaughn.
Oh, is he coming?
So
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
I didn't know
TV
that.
Go on the Bloomberg at 10.
I can't convey the importance of this essay in Project Syndicate. Mr. Phelps is of a certain vintage to bring a history into it, and for everybody caught up in the moment, he pulls us back over 100 years to the mysteries we've seen about wage growth and about labor as well. I put that out on Twitter. I'll continue to advance that over the coming days.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not and, as simple you know, as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.